Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast on a long holiday weekend. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we are joined by Bill Kristol, who is a founder and editor-at-large of the Bulwark and the publisher of the Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, who joined us last weekend for a special weekend podcast, which amazingly had a pretty good audience.
Are you going to make fun of me for being late again?
No, first he's implying that it's amazing that the Sarah Longwell podcast had a pretty good audience, which is pretty harsh, Charlie. I mean, geez, you know.
So Sarah has her
fans out there, you know.
That's right. On the Secret Podcast, we have some rabid fans. Somebody mailed me a seam ripper to help me take the tags out of my shirts after JVL had a long rift about how everybody should remove tags, you know, on one of his obsessive things. And so anyway, somebody cared enough to send me a seam ripper when I said it's not something
okay.
I did.
Well, this
isn't
the difference
illegal
between
to take off those tags. Did you start to always see that on like
mattress? That's only when you're shoplifting.
Oh, okay.
Well, this is the difference between this podcast and the Secret Podcast, because we're not going to be talking about seam ripping or whatever. So let's talk about the very stable genius in the White House. In case anybody missed it, if you didn't get the memo, it turns out the president was calm, very, very calm. And we know that because he brought out his very loyal and very stable staffers to vouch for it. And we had this not at all weird moment at the White House yesterday.
You were very calm.
Kellyanne's right. You were very calm.
Very calm and straightforward and clear.
I'm an extremely stable genius.
Okay, so what do you make of that, Bill Kristol? This strange moment where the president felt the need to call up his aides one by one to say that no, he wasn't rattled at all when he stomped out of that infrastructure meeting.
I mean, let's back up a minute. What's most, even before the amazing moment yesterday, which we should certainly talk about, how bizarre is it to leave the meeting? Let's assume he was calm. Let's assume he didn't stomp. Let's assume he premeditated having them come to the White House and then walk out, which seems to be the case. But didn't he have those things printed up for
the
roast?
Signs,
yeah,
on the
signs
podium.
Ready to go, right? So what is that? I mean, you're president of the United States. You invite, admittedly from the other party, but you invite the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the minority leader of the Senate to a meeting.
These are important.
And it turns
people.
Out, and you walk out. You literally walk in. I guess make 3 minutes of remarks. You're annoyed that Pelosi had said earlier in the day that you're engaged in a cover up, and you walk out. I literally can't even imagine. I don't believe that's happened in modern American history. I mean, there are if you're going to cancel the meeting, have your staff call over and cancel the meeting. The president doesn't think it's the appropriate time for us to meet. To have them come to the White House, I really think that the Democrats have more self-respect. They should just say, we're not going to any more meetings. I mean, because if someone invited you to their house and then they walked out or kicked you out after 3 minutes, after not letting you speak. So even before the degradation of his aides, which Sarah probably wants to comment on here, the behavior, again, vis-a-vis people who are heading other branches of the U.S. government is itself appalling.
Well, the one thing I would just note on that is I don't think it is unprecedented, because didn't 5 months ago he do the exact same thing? He stomped out of a meeting before.
That's true.
It's unprecedented in terms of other presidents, but not for this president. What were they negotiating that time? Do you remember?
It was before the shutdown, maybe, I think.
Oh, it was over the shutdown. That is what it was, where he walked out. And so so our master negotiator, apparently this is one of his art of the deal moves, get mad and stomp out. In this case, what was unprecedented, I think, about it was that they hadn't even started talking.
Right. He walked in, didn't sit down. I mean, it just.
But it was infrastructure week again.
So it was infrastructure week.
Why always infrastructure? I mean, I'm sorry. How did what could have been a signature accomplishment of the administration become the most reliable punchline in Washington, D.C.? Infrastructure week. I mean,
well,
think about that for a second.
It just happens to be one of those things that most people are bought in on. Lots of people would like to see done. And so, of course, it's become the thing that they never pivot to it. They will always put it out there as something they may pivot to one day.
I think Donald Trump always wants it to be out there because he knows he can't actually figure out how to pay for it or cut a deal for it or something like that. But, you know, it also was not unprecedented that he had had his members of his staff abase themselves in this particular way. Larry Kudlow and Kellyanne Conway. Remember when he went around the table and had members of his cabinet, one after another say how much they loved working for him and how great he was and how wonderful he was. And Reince Priebus said every day he thanked God for the opportunity to serve Donald Trump. He kind of likes that, doesn't he?
The abasement is pretty unbelievable. It was unbelievable back then, as you say, a year and a half ago, whatever that was, with the cabinet. But, I mean, I've known Larry Kudlow for 30 years. These are people, Larry, these are not 28-year-olds who were sort of, you know, he's a 70-year-old man who's had senior government position before, and he doesn't need the job, I guess. But they nonetheless, you know, Trump snaps his fingers and they trot over, or in Larry's case, since he had some, I think, surgery on an ankle or knee or something recently, he hobbled over with a cane and to say, yes, Mr. President, you were calm. It's entirely the other side's fault. I mean, it really is beyond. It's like a parody of a third world country almost, you know, Marx Brothers version of a third world country.
Speaking of abasement and Schadenfreude here, when sort of moving ahead, this story about Senator Tom Tillis, I'm sure you saw that. And of course, you know, Tom Tillis is not the worst Republican in Congress in the era of Trump by any means. In fact, he's shown some little, you know, flashes of independence. But when push comes to shove, he always caves in. He was, of course, you know, famously flip-flopped on the president's border emergency declaration. He went out and he wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post saying how he was against it, and then they squeezed him just a little bit, and he totally flip-flopped on it and you know, rushed to Twitter as soon as Charlie Kirk threatened him to say that he was absolutely opposed to the Senate subpoena for Don Jr. Well, it turns out that despite all of that, that the Club for Growth, which has turned itself into a Trump surrogate, is trying to drum up a primary challenge for Tom Tillis. So, you know, despite all of the sycophancy, it might not be enough, and he still may face a primary challenge from a Trumpist.
Yeah, insufficient loyalty. That is the charge against Tillis. Here's what I don't understand, though, about these guys. Lindsey Graham, I would put in this category, too, and maybe one of you can answer this for me. But what is it? Like, is it the worst thing in the world if you lose your primary? Like, these people are, I understand they like being senators, they like being congressmen. But, like, if you lost and you went down on principle, like, I don't know, what's Jeff Flake doing? He got, like, a cush job at, you know, CBS or something, right? Like, you get to go be the president of a college. You will still go on to make millions of dollars and write a book and who knows what. Like, is it worth the abasement? Like, why are they so afraid? Why is this such a thing that that can be held over them?
It's a good question. And I mean, you're right. Also, the I don't know what the way to say it is, the standard disloyalty or of loyalty to which you're held. It is like we're now in the Stalin era in the sense that it's not simply doing something that damages Trump, voting against Trump. It's having had a thought
right.
that you
don't
might do something that
it.
Would go against the supreme leader. And you don't even think about it. I mean, it really is creepy. And I mean, they can primary whoever they want, I suppose. And I have no great sympathy for Tillis at this point, having written an op-ed against the emergency declaration, quite a cogent op-ed against the Congress going along with Trump taking emergency powers, divert funds to the wall, and then voting the opposite way. It's a pretty pathetic flip-flop, and, you know, so I'm not going to shed a lot of tears if he gets primaried, I suppose. But it is really something. I mean, this is what happens though in revolutions, right? The French Revolution and others, famously, they kind of, you know, you're never pure enough. And I think we have seen that happening. Don't you guys think over the last month or two, the Alabama abortion thing seems to be an instance of this. I mean, whatever, on different issues, including an issue like right to life, where Trump has no history or credibility, everyone has gotten radicalized. Everyone wants to be purer than the next person. If you were an incrementalist who worked hard in the pro-life movement for 25 years and incidentally helped reduce the number of abortions in the U.S. and got some legislation passed in terms of partial birth and stuff, it doesn't count. Now, the more extreme you are, the better you are, the more committed you are. I mean, it really is. I think the Trumpism is sort of is percolating out into other areas, even where Trump isn't personally involved.
Well, this is a really good point, because it's moved from, you know, being enough if you were a reliable vote for the Trumpian agenda. You vote for the conservative judges, that was enough. Now you have to be chemically loyal to the president on things like Russia, on things like Don Jr., on everything else. So that is a move. By the way, going back to your point, Sarah, on losing primaries. Yeah, I mean, losing your seat is not the worst thing in the world, you know, we can say. On the other hand, losing a primary is not necessarily the end of your political career. Didn't Lisa Murkowski in Alaska and Joe Lieberman in Connecticut lose their primaries and then go on to be reelected as independents?
Yeah, absolutely.
How about that for a little
Barack
long?
Obama lost the Democratic primary, challenged a sitting House member in 2000, lost 2-1, and was the senator 4 years later and the president 8 years later. So people should, you know, I'm not saying Obama did it out of any great principle. He was looking to move up from the state Senate in Illinois and challenged Bobby Rush and lost. But it is a good reminder that, you know, you can lose and come back. And
well, you can lose and keep your seat. I mean,
in the case of Murkowski and Lieberman. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So let's talk about deep fakes. This is something that we are not prepared for. I think our heads are still on Russian bots from the last election. Deep fakes are these, you know, very convincing video or audio tapes that they can distort what someone says, what they mean. And, you know, people are out there waving their hands saying this is going to be, you know, a factor. Over the last 24 hours, I think we got a taste of what the future is going to look like. You have this doctored video of Speaker Nancy Pelosi slowed down, not a very sophisticated deep fake, but basically slowed down to make it look like she was slurring her words, that she was drunk, that she was, you know, showing signs of age. This thing has already been shared more than 2 million times on social media and pushed out by Trump World, by Fox hosts, by the president himself, and by Rudy Giuliani, who didn't quite pull it off, did he, Sarah? He didn't quite.
No.
What happened? What?
Yeah, what's that Mark Twain quote, isn't it? Like a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its shoes on. Yeah, this is what we're facing in this new world where you can do so much with technology to mess with things. But what was great is in the case of Nancy Pelosi, where the video was doctored to make it look like she was, you know, drunk, I guess, or slurring her words. Then Rudy Giuliani tweeted, "Ivis apology, it's spelled IVESSSS apology for a video which is allegedly is a caricature of an otherwise halting speech pattern. She should first stop and apologize for saying the president needs an intervention."
Okay, now for people just listening to that, if you're trying to figure out what was he saying, it's completely incoherent.
It's completely incoherent.
Well, do you think he's trying to make fun of that? I mean, trying to imitate a halting speech pattern? That's what I took that as. Or is that too sophisticated?
Oh, come on.
That is a self-own on top of a self-own.
It's no way.
I'm going to put out a tweet making fun of somebody for getting old and not being able to communicate, and then I put this thing out. It's like, oh, God.
Yeah, do you really think that this was intentional?
I guess it was so ridiculous that I thought it was, but that shows how I'm not really fully adjusted to the age of Trump.
Got me worried that maybe that's true.
Either way, it's ridiculous since it's a doctored video and audio, I guess. I mean, it really is unbelievable. Look, there's a genuine danger here in terms of social media and not just elections, but the whole way we get news and information. And that's a deeper question, which people need to really think hard about. I mean, it is kind of an amazing Orwellian ability to adjust actual history. And not just in the old days, they wiped someone out of a photograph. Now they actually change. And of course, they can change the speech pattern. They can add things. They can take things out.
It'll reverse
the meeting. Yeah. And it could look real. In this case, it looks somewhat real, but it just looks like she's slurring. It's also very revealing that they think this is a devastating hit. I mean, so the question is Trump losing it a little bit? And their answer is, well, Pelosi's lost it. I mean, even if it were true, which it doesn't, there's no evidence that Nancy Pelosi isn't quite sharp and able to do her job as Speaker. So what? She's Speaker of the House. She's elected by her colleagues. She kind of runs the legislative calendar in the House. She tries to persuade her colleagues to agree with her on strategy and various things. She's not the President of the United States. I mean, she has no unilateral power. It would not prove anything. The truth is, in the past 30, 40 years, someone like, I think John McCormick was the Speaker of the House from Massachusetts in our youth, Charlie. And he, I think in the last year or two, people thought he was kind of losing it a little. And the people stepped in and kind of propped him up. That can happen in the House of Representatives. It doesn't answer the question, are we comfortable with Donald Trump in the Oval Office to say, even if it were true, and I emphasize I don't believe it to be true, even if it were true that some senior member of a legislative body were losing it a little bit, it doesn't answer the concerns about Donald Trump. But they think, since it's all whataboutism these days, I guess, they think it's a very good answer.
Yeah, and let me just make one more point on this, which is that with this new technology, right, like obviously people are going to abuse these things. The one thing that you have to guard against it is there will always be conspiratory mongers and things like that. But you would be able to count on a president and a president's allies and people of that stature to not share and disseminate things like that. And that is where this administration is completely different, where not only will they do it in some cases unwittingly, but they'll do it wittingly as well.
Okay, this is why this is worse than I think people think it is, because this is sort of just a hint. It's like a little hors d'oeuvre of what's coming. So you have these deep fake videos, and people are focusing on the technology of all of that. But I think what you saw with the way it was exploited over the last 24 hours, you see the context here, the bad faith exploitation. I mean, the willingness of players like Donald Trump and his allies to push this out, whether they knew that it was fake or not. And you have people who have become just inured to lying, inured to pushing stuff out. You know, if it helps our team, they're going to do it. So this new technology is coming online at the very moment when the political culture has been corrupted and when the field has sort of been prepared for all of this, because you actually have a lot of people in the audience, in the electorate, who are either extremely gullible or, frankly, don't care that much. And this is the other thing, that, you know, after a while, you could have a videotape of the President of the United States dropping the N-word. You could have him beating baby seals to death with the bodies of baby whales, and people will look at that and they'll go, I don't believe it. It could be deep fake. So you do have this annihilation of truth. You don't know what to believe anymore.
No, I think that's a good point. You know, you both made it is very worrisome. And again, sort of Sarah's point here on the in a normal world, if I can get it that way, and this stuff started to show up. What can you imagine? You could imagine a president of one party and a speaker of another getting together and saying, you know what, this is a danger to the political discourse, to the political process. We're calling on all of our members of both parties, all the candidates of both parties, to be careful when they and to ask their supporters to be careful when they distribute videos and audios and make sure they're real. In fact, we're setting up a bipartisan commission to figure out whether there should be some monitoring group of this. I mean, these are all, just saying, this is kind of the normal stuff that would happen if a technology like this emerged. And of course, there'd be people on the fringes who would ignore the representation, the requests of the leaders of the parties and the bipartisan commission and all that, but at least there'd be sort of a good faith effort to marginalize this sort of stuff in American politics. This is the absolute opposite. Trump wants this to be at the center of his party and of our politics.
And the other danger, of course, is that people, you know, believe what they really, really want to believe is true. You know that if there's a video that makes Donald Trump look bad, you know, that will be tweeted out, you know, by millions of people in the resistance, just like we're seeing right now. And I had a piece up about Michael Avenatti this morning, you know, asking whether or not we've learned anything from him. And you look back and you go, why did everybody get sucked in? I mean, you know, he was on cable television 250 times in about a year. That's more than if he'd been a full-time employee. And yet that confirmation bias is just so strong. And I think that this is one of those examples how we need to police our own side. I mean, we've been trying to do this at the Bulwark. There are a lot of grifters and hoaxers and just complete trolls on the right. And we're going to call them out. But because it's important, I think, to police your own borders. But, you know, the left has its same problem. I mean, they have their Omarosas. They have their Michael Wolves, you know, Wolf. And they have Michael Avenatti. By the way, did you guys ever appear with Michael Avenatti? You ever meet him?
I met him in a green room. I don't think I was ever on air with him. I met him in a green room literally like twice, I think, for 2 seconds.
Yeah, I do.
I mean, I'm not going to defend just how breathlessly everybody was willing to like throw Michael Avenatti on the air. But I will say there is a reason that there's such a low class of people that we now have to sort of deal with that become these weird sort of folk heroes to the left. And it's because Trump brought them into his administration in some way, whether it's Michael Avenatti we got because he slept with a porn star, paid her hush money to cover it up, and she got a lawyer, and that guy was Michael Avenatti. So we can thank Trump for that. You know, Omarosa was a part of the administration. Lots of other people that are now sort of anti-Trump forces are people who were part of the administration, and the fact that they are of low caliber in terms of their truthfulness and whatnot, that is all a gift that has been given to us from the world of Donald Trump.
Okay, so I got a question for you two. I realized that as soon as I posted the article that I probably should have disclosed that somewhere out there on social media there's got to be a picture of Michael Avenatti and me standing in some green room. Should have disclosed it, that there's a picture of that.
No, and you said, didn't you say in the article you had a little parenthesis, mea culpa, you might have praised Avenatti once or twice.
That was my lame attempt at ass covering. Do you think it was sufficient? Well,
yes, I do not. Look, you were entitled to say that it's very unfortunate that this guy pulled off his stunt, and if we got... I mean, not even taken in. I mean, he was actually Stormy Daniels' lawyer. I mean, it wasn't crazy to have him on discussing that case.
Right.
And indeed, he exposed certain things. It turned out, and I don't know how we can be quite responsible for knowing this, that he's also a probably a dishonest lawyer and all kinds of other things. It was pretty obvious pretty early that he was an incredible publicity hound. And I don't think people like us gave him a whole lot of credibility in terms of his general views on politics. It was just that he, as Sarah said, in one particular case, he had actual knowledge of something and was in the middle of it. So it is sort of complicated about how to stop these guys from then, milking that and becoming all-purpose candidates. But whatever. Anyway, he became a Democratic Party favorite for a couple of months and weeks. He faded away. And whatever you think of the Democratic Party and their candidates right now, Joe Biden is leading the pack, which is not Michael Avenatti.
No, but the damage that he caused to the Democrats is considerable. I mean, I think that his last minute disastrous attempt to derail Brett Kavanaugh, I think, backfired pretty badly. And I think we'll see whether we've learned any lessons. I'm guessing the answer is no. When Michael Wolff comes out with his second book, despite the the shambolic nature of his first book, whether or not he gets the same sort of, fawning treatment, although that ended badly when Mika Brzezinski actually threw him off the set of Morning Joe, which you don't see.
And with Kavanaugh, it's sort of interesting, right? I mean, that was a pretty low moment, and I think in terms of the level of discourse in America. But it did actually backfire, as you say, which is good. It shows that the system has some ability to distinguish between, let's say in the Kavanaugh case, possibly correct memory of something that had happened 30 years ago in which someone comes forward and presents herself. And again, we can then debate whether, all the details of that. And Avenatti's intrusion with a totally, pretty obviously after a day made up kind of charge just to grab spotlight, which ended up backfiring and damaging them, which is, in a way, as I say, the system worked in a sense.
Okay, let's talk about how the system is working right now. The president issued a number of orders, including an order to the intelligence community to cooperate into any investigation of the origins of the Russia probe, and has basically given Attorney General Barr this plenary power to declassify any information related to that investigation, even giving him the power to override the objections of the original agencies that classified it, including the CIA and the NSA and et cetera, which is really incredible. And I've been told unprecedented power for the Attorney General. So, in Trump world, they're saying, well, see, he's going to declassify everything. We're going to see everything. And, you people wanted transparency and you're going to get that transparency good and hard. But I guess the question is, how confident are we that Bill Barr is going to exercise this power even handedly and reliably and that he's going to reveal everything, or whether or not he's going to be, shall we say, selective in what he declassifies?
I think I really would need to look into this in more detail and exactly what I'm not sure if we've even seen the executive order. I mean, the president has obviously the power to declassify what he wants. There are all kinds of processes set up in the U.S. government. I remember them from when I was in there for sensitive material to be declassified and for agencies to have a formal process where they would weigh in and say, this one you really shouldn't. You may not know this, Mr. Attorney General. From your point of view, it just looks like it's evidence for a court case. This happens all the time, actually, routinely. And you don't see a problem. But trust me, this is revealing something about our sources and methods that you don't quite understand what it's revealing, but our friends over in Russia or China would. And that's a process that exists, and it's a little cumbersome and all that, but it works adequately, I think. Now, if Barr is simply sort of been delegated, asked by the president to run this interagency process, and if he will take seriously the objections of CIA and NSA and all that, I suppose it could be an adequate outcome. It's a little weird. I mean, there's a reason the president, makes resolves, because justice has its own biases in some of these cases. Justice would always want to make stuff available, and the agencies, the intelligence agencies, will always want to hold stuff back. So I think it's not a good sign that he's doing this. I mean, one can hope that Barr will behave responsibly on serious matters of national security. There'll be huge pressure on him from the Hill, though, to declassify things right and left. And so it's not a good sign, I would say.
And Sarah, this is, I think, sort of underlies the way in which, since the Mueller report was released, the Democrats seem to be kind of flailing around. They haven't settled on a strategy. And yet in the interim, the Trump White House and Trump world, they have really felt emboldened and they've gone on the offensive. So not only are they not back on their heels trying to defend the clear evidence that the president may have obstructed justice and conspired with the Russians, but now they're putting a lot of energy and a lot of juice behind the investigation of the investigators. You know, the president of the United States is openly accusing some of our, you know, top intelligence and law enforcement officials of acts of treason.
Yeah, the treason stuff is nuts. Just incredible that he, I mean, isn't, what's the punishment for treason?
Death.
Death, right? So that seems extreme. This may be controversial with the two of you. I don't know. I'm like totally not at all exercised about them doing an investigation into how it started. Like at this point, it has become such a, Kimberly Strassel writes about it constantly. You know, Molly Hemingway talks about it constantly. Andrew McCarthy at NRO talks about it constantly. Like there is a real Fox News endlessly talks about this. Like it seems like it's actually probably good for the country for there to be a definitive report where they come out and say, yeah, well, you know, Papadopoulos was talking to a lot of Russians and it was pretty weird. And that's why we got a FISA warrant through the courts and it wasn't predicated entirely on this Steele, you know, dossier. And like, I don't know, it feels like that's okay with me if that they do that. I'm not gonna, it's, is it, does it totally political? Of course. But at this point, I think that we pushed and hard for transparency around the Mueller report. I think it's good for the country to know if they're really concerned about it, that there be transparency on how it started. And let's just get that everything out in the open and talk about it.
I agree with most of that, except that I'm right now at a zero level of trust for Bill Barr. I mean, he's basically exposed himself as very much a partisan player and a hack, somebody who is willing to go to extraordinary lengths to defend the president, even at the expense of his own reputation. So we'll see. Okay, so in the time we have left, though, I am sitting here in Wisconsin, so I'm obviously going to be concerned about agriculture. Actually, I'm not. I'm living in the city. So the president came out yesterday, and he announced another bailout plan for farmers, $16 billion to help offset the losses from the trade war that he started. This is on top of the $12 billion bailout that, you know, from just last July. And of course, one of the questions that just I want to leave out there is, so the president can spend this money without congressional action, and apparently. But, you know, James Holman over at the Washington Post just makes a great point that, you know, Trump keeps trying to pick the winners and losers, you know, from this bailout to who builds the wall. You know, this is a hands-on, you know, a guy. And one of the consequences of this economic policy is guided by, not by the free market or the invisible hand of the market, than by the heavy hand of the central government. You know, these are, this bailout, these are government handouts. And kind of amazingly, the conservatives, you know, who pretend to support free markets, are going along with all of this. But, you know, this is a very transactional presidency where more and more power is not only being shifted from the market to government, but within the government, into the hands of the president himself. And so you now have much of, you know, American agriculture dependent on government largesse and handouts as opposed to the free market. And this is happening under an allegedly conservative president.
Yeah, and it's government handouts that are required because of Trump's own policies. I mean, it's one thing if there's a drought. Now, we conservatives have always even been worried in a way about handouts in that case, because sometimes you want to say, look, you know, you just want to let nature take its course here, and you can't be making up for every time there's a bad year. But then if there's a good year, they don't give that back, so to speak. But this is Trump's own policy. So he gets to indulge in his tariffs, which are foolish and ill-advised. He then sort of makes it up to the farmers short term to keep them on board, presumably for voting purposes. Longer term, it doesn't do any good. I mean, you still have a distorted market and so forth, and you've lost your markets abroad. And what are we going to do, endlessly pay people in Iowa to grow soybeans that we no longer sell to China because of Trump's idiotic trade war? I guess that's what we'll do. And in fact, as you say, huge amounts of ink have been spilt in conservative publications over decades saying, here's an example of a government program that got set up. Maybe there's even a good reason for it. There was a bad year, and now we have, you know, 40 years later, we have various subsidies and handouts. But this is really directly political. And it would be nice if someone stood up in the Senate or the House and just said, this is not why I got myself elected to Congress, to vote for this kind of payout.
You know, Sarah, it is not hard to imagine what conservatives would be saying if a President Obama or a President Warren or President Sanders was doing this kind of thing, this sort of, you know, national industrial policy. You know, Mnuchin's basically now acknowledging that he's been haggling with corporate executives about prices, that he's lobbying Walmart not to raise the prices. I mean, that's not been the role of the Treasury Secretary. You had the Commerce Department with this massive power to grant waivers to exempt companies from tariffs. I mean, you win, you lose. I mean, it's, you know, an American economy where, you know, if you're in business, you almost are obliged to come in and kiss the ring of the folks in Washington, D.C. And, you know, this is the kind of central planning and centralization of power that I thought conservatives were at least united on that, right?
I mean, does socialism suck or does it not suck? Charlie Kirk has told me reliably that socialism sucks. And this is more of like a socialism for me and not for thee type of attitude coming from the White House. And, you know, just, I mean, what will always, it will never stop shocking me. I will never become completely inured to some of this is like the moral, there's a lot of, out of this administration, right? There's a ton of moral and ethical failings across the board. It's relentless. But, you know, the policy's been a mixed bag. But this is one of those policies that, as Bill said, is like so central to who we are as conservatives and why many people would even identify as conservatives. And so watching Republicans on these policy issues that they've promoted for all of these years suddenly just be like, oh, yeah, no, we're for crony capitalism, or we're just going to be quiet here about crony capitalism. That to me, all of it's stunning. But that to me is sort of bizarre.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Holman makes this point. This is economics 101. Central planning like this, referring to what the Trump administration is doing, central planning like this has never worked in the long run because it distorts incentives and no bureaucrat setting prices in Washington can outsmart markets. You know, 5 minutes ago, 99.9% of Republicans would have nodded their heads and said, yeah, that's why we're Republicans. That's why we're conservatives. Now, I mean, Charlie Kirk, when he says that people don't understand what socialism is demonstrating that he doesn't understand what socialism is. At all. Okay, so this is an awkward question. Why does this keep happening to Charlie Kirk, nice guy like Charlie Kirk, TPUSA, Turning Point USA, another one of their superstar kids, this Kyle Kashov, who was one of the survivors of Parkland, who became just one of their rock stars, you know, is now apologizing for these racist slurs that he had written. I mean, why does it keep happening that these young activists engage in this and then turn around and say, well, I didn't mean it. That's when I was a kid. I mean, first of all, I'm willing to forgive a kid for being a stupid kid. Okay. Now, I never wrote those things when I was a kid. I was a stupid kid, but I was never that stupid. But on the other hand, I do think it's, you know, reasonable to, you know, cut, you know, children some slack. But isn't this also an argument why it's not a good idea to turn these children into political celebrities, you know, on one side or the other side?
Especially when being a celebrity these days, you're just rewarded for being more extreme, more shocking, and more outrageous. And I think on the right, especially, I really do feel this, that we discussed this way at the beginning, the degree to which you just, in every area, language, policy, expression of opinion, you know, expressing disdain for anyone on the other side, even if they're people of real accomplishments and even heroism, a John McCain type. I mean, you just are rewarded for all the incentives seem to be to go in that direction. And it's bad. And it does have an effect. People say, well, it doesn't have any effect. It's Trump popping off or someone else popping off. And, you know, but it does. People see it and they go in that direction. And, you know, fine, they get chastised and maybe they apologize and come back a little bit. But you really don't want a society and a political system, in a sense, where the rewards are for being ever more irresponsible and ever more, you know, sort of, well, just irresponsible and disgraceful, really.
You know, I started noticing this back at like 2015, 2016. It was probably happening before then, but it was in my mind, I described it as kind of this vortex sucking people to the more extreme levels, that if you wanted to be on cable television or you wanted to be, you know, invited to these conferences, you had to be more shrill. And then you apply that incentive structure to kids who are very, very impressionable, you know, and you start seeing, I mean, I actually remember when Charlie Kirk sounded rational in public, you know, before he's flying around on Air Force One and sucking up and feeling the need, you know, to tweet 20 times a day about how wonderful Donald Trump is. I mean, there's something in the dynamic that is dangerous for kids. And, you know, it's, look, human beings can be easily flattered. Their heads can be turned. They get, you know, drawn to power and celebrity and sex and all of that. So we all get that. But, you know, it's worth reminding that perhaps 16, 17, 18-year-olds are not the most reliable people to shove through the curtain and make the spokesman for a political cause. So, Sarah, what am I missing today?
I'll comment on this just because we've been talking about abortion so much in the last couple of weeks, and people talk about, you know, kids. And I guess this is such an important conversation, and it's one of the ways that we're really just sort of desperately failing kids. I think about whether it's the Covington case where people were, you know, everybody got really mad at that kid and like what that kid, you know, and then it all came out, right? People were like doxing him, and then people were making him a folk hero, and everybody was using him as a litmus test for their own political, you know, feelings and anger and passions. And we're doing that with kids a lot, across the board on the political sphere. And we like, you know, like, and so then people go back, right? You get somebody, I can't remember, I don't know the sports ball well enough to say this exactly right, but like some kid won the Heisman or some trophy, and then somebody went back and found, you know, some like anti-gay tweets he tweeted when he was like 16 years old, and they used it to burn him. And I just, the technology and the way that, you know, I mean, thank God I didn't have Twitter when I was 16. Who knows what I was saying? And basically, because, and I guarantee you it wasn't, you know, racist or anti-Semitic, but I'm sure I was working through ideas in a way where they couldn't possibly be applied to the adult standards of real thought. And it's just, it is really unfair. So the best thing we can do is try to help kids understand is not to be part of a system that catapults them into the public eye for having an opinion, good or bad, that we say to ourselves, like, hey, that kid's 17, like, let's just not engage it in a major way.
Well, and that's also why you want to have powerful role models, right? Because, you know, you're unformed, you're attracted to maybe extreme things. That's why you want to say, hey, wouldn't you like to be like William F. Buckley or George Will or Bill Kristol or Charles Krauthammer? You know, that's how I did that, is throw that in. You know, as opposed to, you know, here are books you should read, as opposed to going to a CPAC conference, you know, and jumping around with Candace Owens. I mean, there are, this is why, you know, the responsibility of any movement is to channel people into constructive areas, you know, and say, okay, this is acceptable, and you don't want to become this person. You don't want to be the person running around on campus in diapers.
Yeah, this is such an important point, is that movements do have a responsibility to sort of elevate kids in a responsible way. And that is actually something that I would say on the right had been doing extremely well. Like, I came up through sort of a conservative pipeline of intellectuals where I had people that I looked up to who were sober and serious. And if you're a Republican, you know, who's 19 right now, and you're looking for an example of how people behave, and Donald Trump's your example, like, that's a disaster for us as a country. Not like me when I was a kid and I had people like Charlie Sykes and Bill Kristol to look up to.
Oh, God. Now she's making us feel old, Charlie.
Well, trust me, I already felt that way. But no, this is really important, because I am old enough to remember when the conservative movement and some of the major foundations actually funded organizations specifically designed to bring the best and the brightest conservative voices onto college campuses. You know, and they understood they were in a battle for ideas. And so they underwrote professors, they underwrote books, and they had organizations that encourage young people to form conservative newspapers, with mixed results. Obviously, there were some upsides and some downsides there, you know, but somewhere along the line, you know, you start picking, you know, looking what's going on, and it's the Milo Yiannopoulos sort of being invited to campus, and, you know, the Charlie Kirks who've become the face of conservatism on campus. And boy, that is a major departure, and it has had, as you point out, disastrous consequences.
I do think a lot of young people have been on campus a fair amount this spring. You know, there are a lot of young people who see that, who don't like it. They're very, you know, you look at the applications for something like the Hertog program or the Hudson program, which are short, you know, several weeks of really high class education for good students here in Washington. Not particularly conservative, but, you know, sort of non-left, let's say, education and great books and political philosophy and the American founding and that kind of thing. You know, hundreds of applications for just dozens of slots. So, and I struck when I was on campus how many people wanted recommendations of things they could read and, well, you know, but so, but I, so it's nice that the kids react a little bit and they know there's something better. But yeah, we're not doing a good job of helping them find those things.
Well, once again, thank you for joining me both of you, Bill and Sarah.
Thanks, Charlie.
Have a great weekend.
And for our Friday and long weekend podcast. And thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. We'll be back on Tuesday, and we'll do this all over again.